This is a podcast from ABC Radio Overnights. I'm Rod Quinn.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You've written extensively on this issue. Tell me, how do you feel? What do you think when you hear of the latest mass shooting? What was your immediate thought?
My immediate thought when I heard about the shooting in Las Vegas was, unfortunately, that it had eclipsed Pulse as being the most lethal mass shooting that we've had. And of course, that was something that was immediately going to get played up. But the other thing that I thought about as the details began emerging, and thanks, the police did an excellent job in trying to give the public as much information as possible, as quickly as possible, but making sure that that information had been vetted and was correct. I started to think that while there are certain similarities between Las Vegas and other mass shootings, there's certainly some differences that we're seeing here.
So what we've seen in the past is generally one or sometimes two people going into a school or some public area like a nightclub and opening fire. We don't often see somebody from a tall building shooting at random at large groups of people.
That is an excellent point. And that was one of the things that really stood out to me when the story first broke. It hasn't been since 1966 with the University of Texas shooting up at the clock tower that we've seen somebody have a sniper position. As you so correctly pointed out, usually we're seeing the perpetrators on sort of a level field with their victims. So it's more linear than, sort of the sniper directive.
So you mentioned the tower in Austin, the University of Texas. For many people, that is the start of these sorts of mass shootings by a lone gunman, usually, or maybe one other, shooting at random at strangers. Is that where it kind of begins, the modern history of this sort of behavior?
Not necessarily. I think for, a more modern perspective, absolutely. But we've, in our research, been able to trace mass shootings and public mass shootings more specifically back to the late 1800s. I think where the public becomes, more aware of events like UT shooting is the fact that that was really one of the first that was televised. Right. Of course, not in the way that we see shootings being televised today. But it also correlates to what one researcher named Grant Dewey calls the second wave of mass murder. We've had two distinct waves of mass murder here in the United States, the first back in the 1920s and 30s, when there was a lot of familicides for farmers and other people in agricultural and industrial professions who just couldn't provide for their families during the Great Depression. And so we saw a lot of familicides. So they were more private types of mass killings. But starting with the UT shooting and moving forward from there, we've started to see more public mass shootings, and that's what he calls the second wave of mass murder.
Does that happen in other countries around the world, or did it happen at that time around the world in other countries? I know in Australia we've had our share of mass shootings, the last major one being more than 20 years ago now. But is this something that happens elsewhere?
It does happen elsewhere, but I think the interesting thing is it doesn't happen with the frequency or the count. There's two different ways we can look at statistics over time, and that is either count, sort of how many events have happened, or rates. How many events or how many fatalities have there been per 100,000 people in a population? Because you're going to have 100,000 people in the United States is the same as 100,000 people in Australia. So, quantifiably, we do have more events here in the United States. As a rate, our rate remains pretty stable, and given the year, it could be higher or lower than other countries. But there have been extremely high-profile shootings in Norway, also in Germany, Finland. So, it's not a global problem, but it's not solely an American problem either, if that makes sense.
Okay, we're talking about mass shootings. Tell me what your definition of a mass shooting is.
So one of the things when we sat down to write our book that we really, tried to focus on was the sort of disparities in existing definitions that would be overly broad or overly narrow such that events were included or excluded. One thing that our definition does is it really focuses more on considering the motivation, also taking into account who might have been present. One of the definitions that's been put out relies on either three or four fatalities. municipalities, but we know over the years that there's been advances in medical technology, police response, other first responders arriving. And so there's a lot of reasons why the fatality counts aren't higher, but the shooter still intended to kill those individuals. One thing that I should note with our specific definition that came out in our book is our book was actually put out or sent to our publisher prior to the San Bernardino shooting. And so now what we're seeing with events like San Bernardino and Pulse is sort of a melding, if you will, of terrorists who use mass shootings versus other types of attacks, such as bombings or, vehicles like we've seen in Europe. So if we had to go back, I'm sure that we would kind of take the strict no terrorism policy out of it, because that's certainly something we didn't have to consider when we did create our definition.
In Australia, we look at the US and think, well, they seem to have mass shootings all the time. Is that the case, do you think?
No, and I think that also speaks to the definition issue. There's some organizations that have put out that there's been, 300 shootings since Sandy Hook or 9,000 shootings this year, and it goes to just speak to, again, how they're defining the events, which then will dictate how many events that they're able to track in a given year. Crime in the United States, we do have, a high crime rate compared to other industrialized nations, and we have a high murder rate compared to other industrialized nations. But our homicide rate in this country, or our homicides, account for 0.1% of all of the offenses known to law enforcement. And that's not to mitigate any homicide. The loss of one life is absolutely one life too many. But when we talk about mass shootings, we're talking about a fraction of 0.1%. So while it seems that they're happening all of the time due to the amount of coverage and attention that they receive, they're really not.
So do you think the better way to deal with this is not cover them?
No, I think that we definitely learn a lot. And we live in a society where the public definitely has a right to know and is also very curious. And I think, making sure that we're putting, or the media and law enforcement collectively are putting out that information can actually help to mitigate, sort of the what ifs or, the conjuring up of false information, which then can lead to even more hysteria and potentially more copycat shooters. I just think that the reporting has to be done responsibly, and I think that there needs to be less of a focus on glorifying the shooter and more of a focus on honoring the victims and getting those communities the resources that they need.
Okay, so with the coverage that we're getting at the moment, how does it usually unfold? What is the coverage like? Because what I've noticed, certainly with this, and maybe it's a way that some people on the right of politics and supporting the NRA like to report these sorts of shootings, is that they do concentrate on the victims and they don't talk very much about the perpetrator or the fact that he had access to a large amount of weapons, that in fact that deliberately then they talk about the victims and the first responders to avoid talking about the perpetrator.
I haven't really seen that much in the way of coverage here in terms of more of a focus on the victims. They're certainly being mentioned. I know that Anderson Cooper on CNN does a fantastic job of really trying to focus more on the victims, and there's other news personnel that do the same. But there's sort of this knee-jerk reaction to really focus on reporting on the shooter. And what's particularly noticeable in this case is I've seen a lot of normalizing the shooter, saying, well, he wore flip-flops and sweatshirts, like most, a lot of people in America wear flip-flops and sweatshirts. And, he was an accountant and he was a retired postal worker, which, of course, back in the 1980s, we had a string of mass shootings that involved postal workers, and that was where the phrase going postal came. So it's kind of bringing that connotation back. There's pictures that were circulated that sort of normalized him. And I stress that, under the No Notoriety campaign, which I do support, it was started by Tom and Karen Teves after their son Alex was killed at Aurora. They don't say you can never name this individual. They're just saying that you need to limit it. And I think, that's one thing when you're seeing a newscast over and over and over again, just, looping the same picture and saying this individual's name, it sort of has that very negative connotation.
What I've noticed also, though, is the way that the tragedy is reported is that the victims, they're talked about like they were victims of something like a plane crash or something accidental, rather than something that somebody did deliberately.
Right. And again, I think that kind of speaks to sort of normalizing the behavior. And what's really interesting, and I noticed this, and I'm not sure if any of your listeners or you noticed this, when they covered the Pulse shooting last year, they hadn't even released the fact that the shooter had called 911 and pledged allegiance to ISIS in the middle of his rampage. And people were already starting to call him a terrorist just based on the fact that he was of Middle Eastern descent and had practiced the Muslim faith. And now what we're seeing is we're dealing with a white shooter, and there seems to be a normalization of his behavior, or such a justification to mitigate his actions, like, well, he had a gambling problem or he was mentally unraveling. And it's, why are we not calling it terrorism if they are very similar and the only difference is the color of these individuals' skin?
Jackie Schildkraut is our guest. She's Associate Professor in the Department of Public Justice at the State University of New York, and has written or co-written the book Mass Shootings, Media, Myth, Realities. What are the myths, then, about mass shootings that we should know more about?
You know, I think that one of the interesting myths really centers on the perpetrator, and it's sort of the perception that it's only white males who are doing this, that it's always assault rifles, and neither of those things are actually factual. White males do account for about 54% of shooters, but we've seen shooters who are Muslim, we've seen shooters who are black, we've seen shooters who are Asian, we've seen shooters who are female. The other sort of, as I mentioned, kind of myth is that it's always these, you know, very high-profiled assault rifles, automatic weapons, very similar to what we heard in the audio or video coming out of Las Vegas. And in reality, in about 50% of cases, it's using handguns. So it's, you know, one of those things where assault rifles sound very scary. People often confuse the AR-15 as AR standing for assault rifle when it actually stands for Armalite rifle. But it's that negative connotation that the bigger and badder and scarier the gun, the more that we should be afraid. And like I said, in reality, mass shooters often use handguns.
So as we look at how the story of these mass shootings unfold, though, going back to, say, 50-odd years ago with the Texas Tower sniper, are they now closer together and more victims? That what we've seen now is almost an arms race, like, well, the next one's going to be worse than the one we've just had in Vegas where 58 people died, and that was not long after the Pulse nightclub shooting, which also at that point was the record number of people who were killed. Do you think that they are getting closer together and worse?
I definitely think that we've seen deadly mass shootings for quite some time. Of course, as you mentioned, the UT shooting, he killed 16 people. It's not 58, but 16 is still a very large body count when the average is around 4.2 per shooting. And again, I want to stress to your listeners that the loss of one life in any of these events is absolutely one too many, which is why I do the research that I do. And we saw very lethal shootings in the 80s and the early 90s with the San Ysidro McDonald's, with also the Luby's cafeteria in Texas, actually not far from the UT shooting. You know, one thing that I really noticed is that it took about 9 years to change over which shooting in our country was the most lethal. Originally, it was Virginia Tech with 32 people killed. And it took 9 years until Pulse happened, whereas now we're seeing over the last 16 months that changed. I do think that part of that comes from the reporting labeling shootings. Of course, it's qualitatively correct that the Las Vegas shooting is now the deadliest mass shooting, as the Pulse shooting was, as Virginia Tech was, as others were. But when you label something like that, it sends to individuals who have the same sort of mindset, here's a goal for you to exceed if you want to be this infamous. And so I think, you know, really kind of trying to minimize the use of that qualifier is really important as well.
So then, is there anything at all that can be done to prevent them other than banning guns totally?
You know, I think what we see, and sort of the gun argument is immediately one of the first arguments that comes up in the wake of a mass shooting. And, you know, in some respects, it's a systems failure. We saw with the Virginia Tech shooter that he was able to legally acquire his weapons because he wasn't reported to the National Instant Background Check System, despite that he had had mental illness and issues related to that mental illness that would have disqualified him, such as involuntary holds in a hospital. So we do have these systems failure issues, but, you know, with this particular shooting, it's sort of a moot point because, you know, one thing is that this individual has been collecting firearms since 1982. And so we don't know if he was just an avid collector who maybe went off the rails, or if he just decided he was going to one day be violent and thought, let me buy these over, 30 years instead of 3 weeks, which he would have raised a lot more suspicion by, going to a gun show and buying 32 weapons or 42 weapons or even the 23 weapons he had in the hotel room. And the other thing I think where it becomes sort of an issue is a lot of the cries in the immediate aftermath before any information was released on the shooting and just the video had been done is people were calling for the banning of automatic weapons. But automatic weapons in this country are banned and you can't buy them. What he had done, which I suspected, was buy semi-automatic weapons and convert them. And so here's a person, again, who didn't raise any flags, had nothing that would have disqualified him from purchasing weapons. So the gun control argument, while there are certain things that can be done in terms of, improving our background check system and making sure that people who are disqualified don't have access to weapons, when somebody hasn't raised those flags, it's very hard to then criminalize a majority to get at somebody that one day might do this that we can't even predict.
So we've had people walk into classrooms and kill 20 mm-hmm. children. We've had people open fire on concert goers in nightclubs as well, theatres. These are just in the last few years and notorious, terrible events. Why do you think it was this time that politicians actually took notice that some people were saying, well, hang on, you need to do something, and all of a sudden some politicians were saying, okay, let's try and ban this particular type of addition to the weapon that makes it from a semi-automatic into an automatic?
I think this is one of the first times that we've really had, accurate video or audio to show, again, that it was converted to an automatic weapon. I mean, I heard it, and not even being a gun user myself, I said, wow, that's definitely automatic fire. I think in the immediate aftermath, there's always this call to do something. And I think that people in our legislation will try to regulate these bump stocks and other things that may have been used in the shooting. But we've seen in the past that these attempts to regulate firearms are largely ineffective. Back in 1999, after Columbine, there was over 800 pieces of legislation that were introduced in this country to try and get at issues such as the gun show loophole that allowed these shooters through their friend to buy these weapons legally without background checks. And ultimately, only 10% of those laws passed, which means that about 720 bills were just essentially wasted time. They didn't get anywhere. And we've seen after Sandy Hook with, the killing of 20 young children and six of their educators that, in terms of legislation, nothing changed. So I don't know that, while it's nice in theory to think that the legislation may be able to make some progress this time around, I don't know how realistic that is.
So do you think, though, that politicians, that lawmakers in the House and the Senate and at state level as well, are comfortable with the number of people killed by guns in America every year? Otherwise, they'd do something about it.
No, I don't think any person could actually be comfortable with the number of people killed per year. And again, that speaks to our, the 15,000 people a year on average that are being killed in just general homicide, not even just a mass shooting. I think that the issue of guns is very politicized. There's, times that we've seen people having guns at work, time we've seen people having guns that don't work. One of the things I think that might be sort of a red flag in trying to pass any sort of legislation is the original federal assault weapons ban that was in effect starting in 1994 and happened to be in place when Columbine happened. And one of the guns that was used at Columbine, the Intertech Tech DC-9, was expressly forbidden under that ban and still was able to be used in what people consider this watershed event that really put mass shootings and particularly school shootings on the map. So I don't think it's that people are comfortable in just saying, well, it's going to happen, we can't do anything. I just think that guns in particular are such a highly politicized issue that there's no real way to make traction because the sides aren't listening to one another.
But is it also the case that the NRA is incredibly influential? It gives a lot of money to a lot of politicians. If that money stopped tomorrow, do you honestly think that the issue would be as politicised as it is?
The NRA certainly is a very heavy hitter and, you know, does a lot of lobbying work and has a lot of support or backing in Congress. I don't honestly know, just given the political climate in general, whether or not anything would change in terms of the ability to pass legislation if that funding stopped. You know, I think one of the major things that kind of is a roadblock in this discussion is a major difference in the two sides' arguments. Because if you listen to the gun rights proponents, they're still saying we support common sense background checks, we support common sense safety measures. I did a show last week where gun owners were calling in and saying, you know, we support common sense legislation that will keep people safe. We just don't want our Second Amendment rights infringed upon. The gun control people are also saying, we want background checks, we want background checks. So they have that place in common. But the difference is that the gun control advocates want to say it's the gun that's doing this, and the gun rights activists are saying, we're not going to say that. And in reality, you know, the guns obviously are the vehicle to make these events happen, but there are individuals on the back end of that gun that are doing the killing. And so I think the gun rights argument is, well, we need to look at this bigger picture. So if they could just kind of work with that common ground, then I think that we might actually get somewhere.
Do you think that, in fact, it's a mistake over the years that the NRA has not been more proactive about this, that they have basically blocked every suggestion to do some sort of gun control, that, in fact, they could have been at the forefront of saving lives?
You know, I think hindsight is certainly 50-50. And, you know, I think one of the things that we have to be mindful of, and I'm not pro or anti-NRA, I just try to stay in the middle of all of this and see both sides of the argument as a researcher. You know, I think one of the things that we have to keep in mind is that any piece of legislation or any roadblock that you set in front of a perpetrator, they're going to find another way to do something if they're that determined to do it. We saw, for instance, on the same day as Sandy Hook, that there was a mass stabbing in a school in China. Somebody walked into an elementary school on the same day and knifed 22 children. So even if we miraculously got rid of all of the guns in America or put these really perfect pieces of legislation that, you know, did all of the right things in terms of restrictions and made absolute perfect sense that we could somehow reduce gun crime to a zero, we would still have crime. We would still have homicides because perpetrators would find a way around that.
Except that we wouldn't have somebody in a building kill 58 people with a knife.
Probably not.
I would say definitely not. It's guns that are killing people. That's the problem. You obviously would have studied what happened in Australia in the wake of Port Arthur. Is there anything that the United States can learn from that?
You know, I definitely think that you guys have made amazing strides in Australia with regards to your gun policies, with regards, more importantly, to your enforcement of those policies. And I think that that's something that we could really learn from in this country. Like I said, you know, we have a lot of laws on the books related to who can and cannot have guns, what types of guns people can and cannot have, you know, where information needs to be reported to so that people that shouldn't have guns are disqualified. But those aren't enforced. And I think that that's definitely a lesson that we could take from Australia and what you guys did in the wake of Port Arthur. You know, for instance, after Virginia Tech, the President Bush, who was our president at the time, signed an executive order that allocated $1.3 billion of federal funding to the states to be able to overhaul their reporting system so that the people who should be disqualified were in the system. And between Virginia Tech and Sandy Hook, only $50 million of that was appropriated. The Brady campaign estimates that there's over 1 million records missing of people that shouldn't be allowed to have weapons and do because they're not being flagged in the system. So I think, you know, one thing that we definitely can take away from you guys is the enforcement of policies rather than the need to just throw additional policies into the mix.
So are you saying that nothing really can be done? You can enforce the laws you've already got, but while the Second Amendment exists, really, these things are going to continue to happen.
You know, I think one thing that I really advocate for as a researcher is, you know, we can't control humans. And I mean, it's sad, and I wish I knew something to do legislatively, any sort of policy-wise that would somehow make this stop. I would do it in a heartbeat and make all the recommendations I could. I think, you know, it comes down to if people are determined to do something, then they're going to do it. And so for me, one thing that I really focus on in my research is proactivity and prevention strategies, and not necessarily relying on lawmakers to pass a bill or a law that's going to somehow hopefully protect me, but to take ownership in my own safety, you know, to make sure I'm practicing my active shooter drills, to make sure that I know where I'm supposed to go and what I'm supposed to do if something happened. The actual likelihood of it happening is extremely low. I have a greater chance of getting struck by lightning, which is also extremely rare. But it's better to know what I'm supposed to do and have those practices in place and not need them than to need them and not have them.
One of the things that often happens after these mass shootings is politicians will always say, now's not the time to talk about legislation or how we can deal with these things. Let's remember the victims. When is the right time to talk about it, do you think?
I think that's a fantastic point. You know, there's always sort of this, you know, oh, it just happened, let's not talk about it. The time that we should have been talking about Las Vegas was Saturday before it happened. We seem to have a very short attention span in America where it comes to mass shootings. And I say we as a, you know, just a society, in that, you know, in the immediate aftermath of the shooting, they say exactly what you just said. It's not the right time to talk about it. Then a week or two in, they're going to get really angry and say, now's the time to talk about it. And they're going to try and put policy into place that's going to fail, and then everybody just sort of, it drops off the radar and everybody sort of moves on. And then when we have the next shooting, everyone's like, well, how did this happen? And it's like, because you haven't been having an ongoing, long-standing dialogue. You have sort of a very reactive focus rather than a proactive focus. And I definitely think that that needs to change.
Jacqueline, I really appreciate your time and thank you so much.
Thank you, Rod, for having me.